It's time for your weekly dose of Wayne's Comics.
Welcome to episode 385 of the Wayne's Comics Podcast. Thanks so very much for listening. This week I've got a great conversation for you with David Popose from Spencer and Locke, which is in the middle of its second series right now, and they're heading toward their second collected edition. We talk about the book, how the first volume was Ringo Award nominated, and how it's described this way. His partner's imaginary, but the madness is all real. It's sort of Calvin and Hobbes to the next level, is the way that I like to think of it. It's a combination of Calvin and Hobbes, Sin City, and Criminal. David and I talk about the book, how it came to be, as well as what we might expect in the future from them. We also talk about what it's like to be optioned and what that means for David. So I'm sure you're going to enjoy what he has to say. There's a lot to get to in this episode, so let's get on with the show. It's great to talk with David Popose, the writer of the Ringo Award-nominated Spencer and Locke. How are you doing today, David?
I'm doing great. Thank you so much for having me.
It's good to talk with you. I met you at MegaCon recently.
Yep.
And it was great fun to do it. We were talking a little bit before I started to record about how packed it was on Saturday, and everybody seemed to do really well that day, so that was a good thing. I was happy for you, too. I think I actually got your first trade on Sunday, if I remember what it was.
You did. It was an incredible show. I mean, especially that Saturday, like you were saying, it was really like a tsunami hit. I mean, there were so many people going through that line. And we were talking about before we started recording, I think I made at least my combined sales of Thursday and Friday on that Saturday, if not more.
Wow.
I just like cleared through. I brought extra to that show thinking, you know, it's a big show. It's Florida. It was my first Florida show. And I was kind of sweating bullets a little bit on Friday thinking, oh, man, I had brought way too much stuff. By Sunday, I managed to clear out the whole thing.
Wow.
So it was a great show.
Wow. Now, this won't matter to anybody else, but just between you and me, you and I were placed well. When you come in the door, that they would, if they went straight, as so many people do, They went straight through the aisle where we were.
Yeah, it was great.
That was couldn't be better. I thought the placement, I just sat there looking out going, how did we ever get placed so well? That was so great. So I'm glad it worked for you too.
Yeah.
That's good. So let's talk about Spencer and Locke. Why don't you tell people, if somebody has not heard of it before, how would you describe it?
So the easy elevator pitch for Spencer and Locke is, what if Calvin and Hobbes grew up in Sin City? It's about hard-boiled detective Locke, who has grown up to become a homicide detective with his unlikely partner, a 7-foot-tall imaginary talking panther named Spencer. I say it's a little True Detective, it's a little Fight Club, and it's 100% a love letter to classic Bill Watterson and Frank Miller. And we actually have a sequel that's in stores now, Spencer and Locke 2. And we've taken kind of the Fables approach to it. No comic strip is safe. We're doing hard-boiled Calvin and Hobbes versus hardcore Beetle Bailey in the form of our new villain, Roach Riley. It's been kind of a fun series. If our first arc was like Lethal Weapon, our sequel is like The Dark Knight. And I couldn't be happier with the response to our sequel. It's been 2 years since our first arc came out. And the fact that our sales have actually stayed steady over the course of those 2 years is really just a testament to, you know, how vocal and supportive our fan base has been. And the fact that we've been getting actually higher reviews than our first arc just goes to show that, I knew my art team, you know, artist Jorge Santiago Jr., my colorist Jason Smith, my letterer Colin Bell, I knew they had all stepped up their game. But seeing that the reviews are higher than the first time, it makes me think that maybe I improved a little bit too. As far as sequels go, I couldn't be happier with the reception we've gotten.
Well, you were telling me that Spencer and Locke is your first comic, right?
Yeah, this is my first published work. I know Jorge, my artist, he had done the self-published route, but this is also his direct market debut as well. And I kind of circled the outside of the industry for a very long time. I got my start as a DC Comics intern I worked on books like Final Crisis, Batman RIP, Green Lantern Secret Origins, the weekly series Trinity. Hmm. And then I worked as the reviews editor at Newsarama for about a decade. Hmm. But it's sort of all that kind of theory was barely enough preparation for me to sort of get a comic book across the aisle. Mm-hmm. I feel like there's only so much you can learn before you have to road test it. Mm-hmm. And I'm glad that I kind of learned how to kind of pick apart the books that I like and the books that I don't like, so I could kind of learn from everybody else's mistakes and kind of put together my own bag of tricks based on stuff that I like from everybody else. It's almost like an overnight success, but it's like a 10-year story building up to it. So yeah, but it is my first book, and I couldn't be more grateful to how people have responded to it.
See, I'm fascinated because, you know, I always talk to people about when they get to be writing and stuff like that. I'm not able to make that creative leap as hard as sure. I try. My stories all tend – I can tell you what a good story is. I write reviews, and I honestly can tell you why I like certain stories and what I think is strong about them. Me actually doing that is something I can't do. I'm just not able to make that leap. You know, sure. All I can do is come up with standard stuff. I mean, I like to be surprised. I can't surprise right. myself for some reason. I don't know what it is. But you're able to do that. I mean, how did you know when the time was right for you to start doing the writing like this?
Well, so first off, I think that's such an excellent question because there's a reason why it took me so long to do this. And it was in part because I never gave myself permission to really think that this was a viable career path. I grew up in the Midwest, you know, St. Louis. And so it's not like I had any sort of, you know, any connections to Hollywood or any sort of professional writers or anything like that. I thought if you wanted to be a writer that had, you know, a stable life and a career, I guess you could work as a reporter, you know, working for a newspaper or a magazine or eventually a website. Mm-hmm. It was, I believe it was the summer of 2014 sounds right. Mm-hmm. 2014 or 2015. That I was reading a lot of comics, you know, especially reviewing them over at Newsarama, and mm-hmm. I wasn't connecting with anything. Mm-hmm. Keep in mind, you know, this is around when the New 52 was kind of sort of really kind of winding down, mm-hmm. and there suddenly kind of had this like little thought in the back of my head, which was, okay, if you're so smart, why don't you do better? Mm-hmm. And, you know, it still took a really long time to build up to that point. I did as a thought experiment. I wrote 52 DC Comics pitches, mm-hmm. saying, well, if the corporate mandate was you have to have 52 books, if I had to pick 52 books, what would they be? Mm. And my only rules were, besides Batman and Superman each getting two titles, there was no duplication. Mm-hmm. And so I was finding, like, if you're going to have 52 different flavors, how do you make them stand apart? And how do you have them sort of inhabit a shared universe while still each sort of accomplishing its own unique directives? Mm-hmm. I did that, and that was kind of fun. Mm-hmm. And then I thought, well, maybe I could write some short scripts and see how that went. Mm-hmm. And so I wrote a short comic script a day for 90 days. Mm-hmm. And that really kind of taught me how to churn through things quickly. Mm-hmm. That's not to say that any of those scripts were necessarily good. Some of them were really not good. Mm-hmm. But it taught me not to be precious with the ideas. Mm-hmm. And Spencer and Locke was kind of my first crack at, all right, like, what if you tried doing a full script, mm-hmm. you know, a full 22 pager? And I really enjoyed it. I tried then, you know, writing a treatment for the rest of the arc. I was like, wow, that went really smoothly. Mm-hmm. So then I was like, well, I'll try to find an artist, see how that goes. You know, the art wound up coming together really nicely. I said, oh, I'll just shop it around, you know, just for fun, you know, just for the experience. Mm-hmm. And that was when Action Lab said, hey, how soon do you think you could get this book done? And that's when it was kind of like, oh crap, this is real. when you say like, how did I get into this position? You know, it was like the frog in the water pot starting to boil, is that I did it very, very, very incrementally and kind of on accident. Mm-hmm. You know, it's so funny that you're saying, oh, I don't know how to put a story together. Mm-hmm. And that's exactly the mindset that I had. Mm-hmm. And it was really only on accident that I suddenly like, tricked myself into actually trying to write something. My opinion, my philosophy on all of it, and I think this is the reason why I'm such a junkie about process in mm-hmm. particular. Mm-hmm. I think there's a lot of mysticism that it surrounds the craft of writing. People kind of see it as you got it or you don't, or, you know, it's sort of this magical skill that, you know, some people have and some people don't. Mm-hmm. And I kind of see it as writing stories. To me, it's like building a chair. Mm-hmm. Anybody can learn how to do it. It's a craft that you can pick up. And of course, no two chairs are going to look the same. You know, some of them are made out of metal, some are made out of wood, some are made out of plastic, some have, you know, four legs, some have three legs, some have just kind of the stool, some are different colors, some have cushions, some have backs, some don't. And that's the sort of individualized spin that a particular writer will add. But the overall idea of a chair, something that you can sit on, mm-hmm. that's universal. And I think that's a skill that anybody can pick up.
Mm. Interesting, because I have to tell you a really quick story. Way back when I started this podcast, I was interviewing Mark Waid, of all people. Mm-hmm. And I was telling him what a genius I thought he was, how he writes himself into this corner, and yet he knows how he's going to get out of this stuff every time. He gets to the, you know, the conclusion comes around, and here comes this brilliant, you know, solution that he had in mind all the time. And he said, well, you know, that's not how it goes. I said, what? And he says, no, it's me and the
swings it.
Yeah. Well, you know, him and the editor sit down, they write themselves into a corner and say, well, later on, we'll figure out something. And they would come back later and then they would bounce ideas around until they finally came up with the idea of how they were going to get out of this solution.
It's funny you say that. I heard him say that at a panel myself. And it just, like, my jaw dropped when I heard that. Because I don't work like that. I can't possibly work like that. Mm-hmm. And so I will say, despite me just saying, oh, you know, there, you know, anybody can learn how to write, of course there are people who just have that sort of natural advantage to it, like a Mark Waid, mm-hmm. who, yeah, they can just, like, figure out a solution at the drop of a hat. Mm-hmm. And I am deeply envious of those people. Mm-hmm. I feel like I've got to really, like, kind of stress test my story in the treatment phase, like, super hard. And it usually takes me a while to kind of crank the script out. But by the time that I have cranked it out, mm-hmm. I know that I've poked it for every possible failure in it. For the most part, iron them out. And then, you know, of course, things change a little once you get into the art stage of the equation, and once you get into the lettering stage of the equation. But usually by the time I actually have the script together, I feel like I've kind of jury-rigged it into something that's pretty solid. Hmm. But yeah, hearing Mark Waid talk about how, like, yeah, they get to a cliffhanger and he has no idea where he's going next. I was like, that's insane. That's crazy talk to me. And it's only somebody as talented as Mark Waid that could pull that off month in and month out.
He says, I'm so sorry to disappoint you, he goes. But, you know, it's interesting you say that, because, you know, I've taken classes with not novel writers in charge. There was a writing class, and he would often describe that the way you do a story is you write out the whole idea, and then what you do is you divide it up in chapters, and you say, mm-hmm. this is going to happen in this chapter, and this is going to happen in the next chapter, and after that and that. And then he starts to write the individual chapters.
Yeah, I think that's a fair way to break it down. I mean, for me, I do something similar to that, although it's not always 100% in linear order. Mm-hmm. Joss Whedon had a phrase that he said, dessert first. And that was kind of like the big light bulb that went over my head, you know, when it came to writing, mm-hmm. was it made me realize, like, oh, if you get stuck in a specific spot, mm-hmm. you don't have to just, like, pound your head against a wall until you break through. You can just skip. Mm-hmm. And so for me, I tend to write sometimes a little out of order. Like, I always try to think of, what's my ending? Once I've thought of a concept, I say, where's the natural conclusion to this? And then I work my way backwards. Mm-hmm. But sometimes I'll say, okay, well, based on this concept, this is a cool sequence that could happen. So for example, Spencer and Locke, you know, because it is an homage to Bill Watterson's Calvin and Hobbes, mm-hmm. the first thing I thought of after writing the first issue was, I said, well, we got to get Spaceman Spiff in there somehow. Mm-hmm. How are we going to get Spaceman Spiff in there? Mm-hmm. And immediately I thought, well, like, okay, this is already a character who his sort of his mental state is a little questionable and he's actively hallucinating all the time. Mm-hmm. What's something that could kind of, like, put those hallucinations into overdrive? Mm-hmm. I thought, oh, well, you know, he gets drugged up, mm-hmm. and he suddenly thinks that he's this equivalent. He's Rocket Man Reynolds, you know, the mm-hmm. sci-fi character. Mm-hmm. I thought of that fairly early on. Mm-hmm. But I do think you're right. You sort of – you break it down to the chapters where you're saying, okay, this is going to be the car chase issue. This is going to be the Spaceman Spiff issue. Here's kind of the big final showdown. And for me, especially writing comics, because they're serialized, it's a nice even way to break each issue down sort of – I think about, like, Friends, where they say, you know, that each episode title is, you know, the one at the coffee shop, or, you know, the one where Ross goes to trial, or, you know, whatever nonsense. And I think about that with my comics as well, as I'm like, oh, this is the one where the hostages get free, or this is the one where the cops show up. And that kind of helps me give each individual issue a little bit of its own identity.
Do you often write the ends first?
I try to. Even not so much writing the full ending, but at least sort of marking down this is where I want it to go. I had a screenwriting teacher who told me, you know your ending. Because to me, writing, whether it's script writing or comic script writing or, you know, or TV or anything you want to say, it's a lot like math. It's a math equation. It's this plus this plus this equals your conclusion. And if your math adds up, then you've earned your conclusion. And you can call it a satisfying conclusion. A lot of times it doesn't add up at the end. And then you kind of like, well, they didn't earn that, or that doesn't feel satisfying, or all that, and they wound up here. So I feel like if you kind of know what the solution to the problem is, if you know where your conclusion is, you can work your way backwards and you can kind of make your story elements balance it out a little bit. You can earn that conclusion. You can earn all those plot points. I always get really kind of jittery if I don't know what my ending is, and I always try to like – I wind up circling that a lot. But at the same time, the other thing that I really try to take into consideration, I mean, once you have sort of the core concept of, you know, your high concept, whether it's, you know, Calvin and Hobbes meet Sin City, or, you know, hostage situation at a wedding, what's the theme? What's kind of the human hook to it? What's the sort of emotion I'm trying to get out of people that's something that people can relate to? It's not to say that every story – every core concept has to be completely relatable. I mean, I'm writing my next book, Grand Theft Astro, is a futuristic time travel story. I mean, I don't think we can all say, oh, well, we've all been there. But we can say that, you know, oh, I know what it's like when I've been surpassed by somebody who I didn't think would surpass me. Or, you know, what happens when your younger siblings grow up. And so figuring out those kind of core human elements also kind of helps steer where the conclusion's going, as well as sort of the intervening story material in the middle.
Yeah. What's really interesting to me is, you know, people often compare it to like driving a car. You can get in a car and you can drive around and just sort of meander around. Sometimes when I would move to someplace new, I'd often get in a car and drive around and get lost, just right. So I could get to know the area. But that's fine for that purpose. But if you're just gonna, if you're trying to get somewhere and you're driving around meandering, it's very unsatisfying. But if you know where you're going and you have the plot, in other words, all laid out where you want to get to, you can often tell in somebody's writing that they have that in mind. They know where they're going because you can feel the writing moving in that direction. And I think that's always a big, strong thing.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, to jump on your metaphor a bit, you know, I always see it as, it'd be like me driving from, you know, my hometown in St. Louis to where I live currently in Los Angeles. And I know I'm going to wind up in Los Angeles. But, you know, there's all these different landmarks that I might want to hit on the way there. I might want to hit Oklahoma City. I might want to hit the Grand Canyon. I might want to hit Vegas. And so once you've sort of got that ending in mind, you've got a little bit of wiggle room in terms of like, okay, maybe you deviate a little because you still have your eye on the final prize. So you're not going to sort of go too far off the rails. And that it makes those little detours, it makes them additive to your final conclusion as opposed to more of a tangent.
Now, I got an email that I didn't realize that was from you about you, which I got a kick out. You were doing publicity for Spencer and Locke Volume 2, which is coming out in August, which I want to remind people. That's going to come out in August, and it's going to be, let's see, I think it's the key code. In fact, it's going to be this month you're going to have to order it. It's JUN191333. It's only $14.99, which is, you know, a pretty good price for a trade paperback these days.
I was going to say, like, I always love having the trade paperbacks. I always say, you know, they're cheaper than a movie ticket. It looks nice and sturdy on a bookshelf. And, I'm actually putting together sort of the final – trade cover today before we started talking. And I'm very excited to see the first volume trade and our second volume trade right next to one another. Especially, you know, people buying that first volume trade, I've spoken with Action Lab and we've already burned through something like 80% of our print run of that first trade. And it's just because people can't stop buying it. So definitely pick up volume two as well.
Good for you. Now, one of the things I noticed in that email was that you're a former crime and politics reporter. How did that help you get to write comics? Or were there talents that you picked up from that you thought were helpful?
Definitely. Well, we talked about this a little bit before we started recording, but comics were always sort of the dream job. But I was also, I was raised in the Midwest. I was raised as a realist, and I thought, what's the stable job? And so in college, I studied journalism, and I interned, in newsrooms all around the country. And when I was interning at DC straight out of college, I was so excited, and I thought, this will be my career. This is where I'm going to stay. I'm going to be a company man. And it was right when the recession hit.
Mm.
So there were no jobs at DC Comics. There were no jobs really anywhere. Mm. And thankfully, I had enough of a resume in journalism that I was hired as a reporter and copy editor at the Berkshire Eagle in Pittsfield, Massachusetts. Mm. It's about as far west as you can go in the state without crossing over into New York. Mm. And yeah, it was, it was a wonderful first job. I did a lot. I covered crime. I covered state politics. I was kind of the Eagle had never had anybody, a really dedicated state politics reporter before. And I would wind up covering all the state representatives and any sort of legislation that was going through. But I also covered the night shift. And so I would cover crime going on in the Berkshires. And for those who aren't aware of the Berkshires, and not a lot of people are, it's a place that's a lot of very wealthy people's vacation homes next to like this really kind of crushing poverty. Mm-hmm. I know that I believe it was Boston or Albany would actually send their trainees from the Crips to the Berkshires as sort of like a training ground because, the police presence wasn't nearly as crazy as it would be in Boston or Albany or even Springfield. Mm-hmm. So you had kind of this drug trade, starting to creep in. And I remember I think it was my first month there. I had to cover somebody got slashed across the cheek. Mm-hmm. It was sort of the snitches get stitches kind
mm-hmm.
of thing.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, it was like, it was such a wild experience, especially for somebody who was only, I think I was 22 or 23 at the time. Mm-hmm. But it was such a great training to becoming a comics writer because you stop being afraid of a word count very quickly.
Mm-hmm.
And you stop being afraid of a deadline very quickly.
Mm-hmm.
And for me, especially the way it really helped is I tend to write kind of modularly
mm-hmm.
because, when you're writing for the newspaper, you get, 6 to 8 inches for the print version, but maybe you'll get another, 4 to 6 inches for the online version.
Mm-hmm.
Or sometimes you kind of have to build upon your story, or sometimes you push your editor a little bit to see how much more leeway you can get. And so you kind of have to prioritize what's the thing that I can't live without having in this story.
Mm-hmm.
And then what are some sort of like additional details that it would be great if you could have it in there, but like if you got to cut it, you got to cut it. I think that was in particular really important for jumping from Spencer and Locke Volume 1 to having a sequel
mm-hmm.
was saying, all right, we're doing our first story. It's going to be just a parody of Calvin and Hobbes. But if we can succeed, here's where we can take the rest of it, sort of going across the funny pages.
Mm-hmm.
And I tend to do that with a lot of my writing is you figure out what's essential and then what kind of stuff. Is it fat or is it additive? And you kind of you sort of get to build your internal barometer that way. And working as a newspaper reporter and as an editor and as a paginator and as a mm-hmm. photographer,
mm-hmm.
you get to learn how to think on your feet very quickly in that regard.
Mm-hmm. Great. And I imagine a lot of the crime stuff has given you some material to draw from for Spencer and Locke because
yeah.
of being a detective and all.
Yeah. Well, I always find that detectives and reporters, they're a little bit like two sides of the same coin. They've got very different directives in mind, but they're operating with very similar frames of thinking,
mm-hmm.
In terms of sort of you're trying to find that thread, you're trying to find that clue, and then you're going to sort of pull on the thread a little bit and figure out where it goes. When you're talking to police officers every single night, even when they don't really want you around,
mm-hmm.
you start to kind of get a sense of what's their deal.
Mm-hmm.
And it certainly helped in terms of establishing tone and figuring out kind of like, well, all right, you go down the wrong side of Cherry Street, in mm-hmm. Pittsfield.
Mm-hmm.
Suddenly you've kind of gone from this nice suburban area to a spot that's like really run down.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, kind of, running through those dark corners a little bit certainly helped influence the tone for Spencer and Locke.
Wow, that's pretty good. That's pretty cool. Because I've got to ask, is Locke...
Yeah.
I understand, you know, the Calvin influence and stuff, but as far as the character beyond that, did you pattern him after anybody in particular?
Yeah, you know, so it's funny because Locke in particular, you know, he's evolved a bit as I've been writing the series. When I wrote the first issue, we didn't have an artist attached. So I it was just kind of me in my mind imagining what the character was like. Mm-hmm. And so I thought of Locke at the time of our first issue as kind of like Marv from Sin City. I thought of Mickey Rourke's voice as an actor when I was writing the script. And Jorge Santiago Jr., my artist, he was the smart person who said, hey, instead of making Locke kind of this big beefy bruiser and having Spencer be this kind of lanky sidekick, let's flip it because you already have – Spencer as his imaginary friend, you know, why wouldn't he be sort of this bigger protector figure? And that way Locke can be kind of this like scrawny guy who like he doesn't know he's walking into a fight by himself mm-hmm. all the time. Mm-hmm. So it makes the stakes even that much higher. It was such a smart idea on his part. And as soon as I saw the designs, I was like, oh, yeah, buddy, you're right. Yeah, I'll let you go do your thing. So once that happened, I was looking at Clive Owen's Dwight from Sin City. Mm-hmm. Starting in volume 2, I've been watching a lot of The Leftovers with Justin Theroux. Mm-hmm. So that really influenced my voice for Locke. Mm-hmm. And, you know, there were a lot of other different influences that kind of went into the blender. There was Leonard from Memento. It's one of my favorite movies. So the idea of a detective having some sort of mental illness or disability and being able to leverage it into a system that works for them, that lets them kind of navigate, you know, society and the rest of the world. Mm-hmm. That's a really kind of appealing concept for me. Mm-hmm. There was Warren Ellis and Declan Shalvey's Moon Knight. Mm-hmm. There's, she never gets enough credit. And so that's why I always talk about her in every single interview. Devin Grayson and Roger Robinson's take on Batman and Batman Gotham Knights. Mm-hmm. Sort of this idea of this guy who's like very profoundly damaged. Mm-hmm. And that sort of damage is kind of, it's almost become its own center of gravity in terms of propelling him from mission to mission. Mm-hmm. That was really kind of appealing for me. And then, you know, also just I laugh and I say, you know, Spencer is a lot like me on a good day and Locke is a lot like me on a bad one. You know, I don't think I'm out there talking to myself in an empty room by myself, but, you know, I can certainly empathize with Locke's temper on occasion, and I can certainly empathize with his sort of sense of intensity, his bull in a china shop, let's just move forward no matter what. Mm-hmm. I can probably empathize with that a little bit more than I should. Mm-hmm. You know, whereas Spencer, you know, I really like his, you know, his sense of humor and his sense of empathy and his sense of compassion. And I always kind of see that, you know, Locke certainly has a core of heroism to him, mm-hmm. but Spencer's kind of the one that encourages that. Spencer's kind of the one that reminds him that, like, oh, there's a greater good for you to be fighting for. So I'd like to think I'm a little bit more functional than my title characters. I mean, I promise my parents did not abuse me by any means. They're very supportive, very lovely people. But I think with any character that you write, mm-hmm. if you find something that you like in them, you'll find that there's always a little something about you that rubs off on them.
It's interesting because you've touched on a subject that I've been thinking a lot about recently.
Yeah,
I'm a big Batman fan, and I watched a special that came out a long time ago about Batman's psychology.
Okay.
And I was so interested in it. You know, they talked about the fact that Christopher Nolan, who did the Batman movies for a while, patterned him after Teddy Roosevelt, who when he was the chief of police, he would ride a bicycle through New York City at all hours of the night looking for bad guys. And he would pound on them with sticks and stuff like that. Huh. And that's where he got the notion for where Batman was or who he is. He based it on Teddy Roosevelt. And I'd never heard that before. I was just fascinated. But it brings up the subject, you know, they got into the notion of how crazy is Batman?
Mm-hmm.
Is Batman crazy? I mean, you know, we always talk about the villains are sort of crazy, but is Batman himself crazy? And when I was reading your book, of course, I had a little of that going on in my head, and I kept wondering, you know, sometimes it's fun to see people who get away with things that we probably couldn't get away with in real life.
Right. Well, you know, it's funny. The word high-functioning schizophrenic is usually what I think of when I think about Locke. Mm. You know, I mean, he's not so far gone that he can't interact with normal human people. Mm-hmm. But, you know, there's something not quite right there. Mm-hmm. You know, and that was sort of part of the genesis of the idea of Spencer and Locke to begin with, was I'd wanted to do a mashup based on that sort of classic old school Frank Miller and Batman Year One, Dark Knight Returns, Daredevil, The Man Without Fear. That was kind of my big seminal book as a kid. Mm-hmm. And thinking, what's the weirdest thing I could throw up against it and still make it make sense? Mm-hmm. And that's when I thought Bill Watterson's Calvin and Hobbes. Mm-hmm. And we talked about this a little bit before we started recording, but there's almost a 10-year age gap between me and my younger siblings. So I was an only child for a long time. I remember being an only child. Mm-hmm. And that was when I read Calvin and Hobbes for the first time. Mm-hmm. And I love Calvin and Hobbes, mm-hmm. but I always thought there was something a little weird that mm-hmm. why would he have this such a vividly imagined best friend, mm-hmm. Imaginary friend, because I was an only child and I certainly didn't have like a vividly imagined best friend. I made friends with real people. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And so as an adult coming back to that, I was like, there is a kind of a sinister undertone to that, especially remembering Calvin's mother. The thing that I would always remember was she had like this volcanic temper. Mm-hmm. And I was thinking like, oh, well, like if he's an adult still with an imaginary friend, like what was his home life like is probably pretty messed up. Mm-hmm. And so, yeah, this idea of kind of Locke being, he is a schizophrenic. He just happens to sort of be able to kind of, hold on to his sanity by the fingernails and kind of point his pathologies in the right direction. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I can definitely see a lot of parallels with Batman in that regard, mm-hmm. because of course, like this is a guy who like he is filled with rage and he has to take it out on the criminal element around him. And while you could certainly go into a deeper socioeconomic theory on this, because it's like, well, you're also the richest guy in the city. And maybe if you just focused on like infrastructure and jobs, maybe most of this wouldn't happen. But it's superheroes. So like, of course, the writers are going to manufacture that conflict. It's a snake eating its own tail. Mm-hmm. But I think in the case of Spencer and Locke, just like Bruce Wayne, these are characters that are like born out of trauma, and their coping mechanisms, mm-hmm. they're not healthy ones, mm-hmm. but they might argue that they make it work for them.
Mm-hmm. Now it's interesting to me because Calvin in the comics, and they reproduce the Calvin series every day, and they're in the middle of a storyline that I found particularly unnerving was when Calvin gets into the family car and takes the shift out of
and it rolls down the hill and rolls, then into the,
exactly it rolls into the ditch, and I just read to the one where the mother's going, that's funny, why is everybody standing around out there, why is that car in the ditch, why if it went into the ditch it would have had to come from our driving lane, and she starts running down the thing. And I always thought, because I was never a Calvin when I was a kid, I was always the good guy. Right. And so when I watched, but Calvin was kind of this release to me that I could watch this crazy kid and he did the craziest stuff and I would enjoy it. And the thing that I also enjoyed was the fact that you talked about Hobbes being well developed. The thing about the strip that always made me concerned was Hobbes really real? Because he was so real in Calvin's imagination. They function so well that we honestly we could believe that with him. And that kind of same thing rolls over into here. You address the fact that Spencer really isn't there. People always say, who are you talking to? Why are you talking to that? And he has to respond, I'm talking to myself kind of stuff. Right. But we honestly have to wonder whether or not Spencer's really real. Mm-hmm. Because if he's real, if he's really being believed in by Locke, I mean, he might actually be real in some sense.
It's funny you say that, because that's my favorite moment of the first volume is we introduce Locke has a daughter in our first volume. Mm-hmm. Her name's Hero. And I thought that was important, just because this is kind of a story of generational trauma. Mm-hmm. And so Locke having a kid, even one that he didn't know about, that's only going to sort of push him into overdrive. He's going to make sure that, whatever happened to him is not repeated on somebody else. Mm-hmm. And we have a scene where, without spoiling too much, she meets Spencer for the first time. Mm-hmm. And she tells him, I didn't know you were real. And it's my favorite line in the whole first volume. He just says, I'll always be as real as you need me to be. Mm-hmm. I think that kind of speaks a lot to the themes of Spencer and Locke in general, which is perspective is reality and perception is reality in a lot of ways, that even though everybody around Locke doesn't see Spencer. Mm-hmm. Locke does see Spencer. He's real enough. And that idea of being able to have this kind of ultimate unreliable narrator, mm-hmm. who's constantly hallucinating, That was kind of the fun of the series for me, is if you can accept that this guy sees a 7 foot tall talking panther everywhere, what else could he see? What else must be true? Mm-hmm. That kind of opens up the floodgates to really kind of any sort of genre that you want. I thought Spencer and Locke was kind of my bucket list book because I did not know if anyone would let me write another comic after this. Mm-hmm. I thought I might be in jail after this. So, I had a kind of the checklist of what would I want if I could only write one comic. And, you know, it's like have the car chase, have some sci-fi, have the big gunfight, have some comedy in there, have some tragedy. Mm-hmm. And when you start on that foundation of somebody with an overactive imagination at best or kind of a sinister pathology at worst, mm-hmm. it really kind of opens up your story to really anything you can imagine.
Mm-hmm. Now, I've got to ask you this, though. I thought about this the whole time I'm reading the books and the issues, first two issues of the second arc. Would Locke really be Locke if Spencer wasn't in his imagination?
That's a great question. And I think the answer has to be no. I think I've been really fortunate in that, you know, especially because for a long time, I was an only child. I tend to have very, very close friendships. Mm-hmm. I still am very close with, you know, childhood friends and, you know, friends of mine from Newsarama. And so those kind of bonds, they shape you. It gives you, a partner to lean on, a friend to turn to, you know, an escape valve when you need it and support when you don't think you can carry on your own. And it's such an interesting question that you say that because, yeah, I do think in a lot of ways the characters of Spencer and Locke, they're very symbiotic. Mm-hmm. And I think, you know, just like Spencer, of course, would not exist without Locke. Mm-hmm. I think we have a little nod to this at the end of our first volume. Mm-hmm. I don't think Locke would still be living if he didn't believe in Spencer. Because I think Spencer has saved his life in more ways than one.
So it might be interesting to explore sometime if Locke couldn't see Spencer for some reason. That might be an interesting see how Locke would react in that circumstance because he's so used to Spencer being there. That's just an idea. It just comes into my head for some reason.
All I'll say is keep reading. Okay. Keep reading. That's all I'll say. We've got a lot of plans about Spencer and Locke and their dynamic. Mm-hmm. And it's one of those things, as we see in the beginning of Volume 2, their friendship has already kind of changed a little bit. Mm-hmm. Locke is under investigation because you don't leave a warehouse full of dead criminals like you do in the first arc and not get called to account for it.
Isn't that very Calvin-like, though?
Yeah, it's extremely Calvin-like.
Calvin went to the principal's office more times than I can think of. And that's when I saw that, I went, oh my gosh, that's so like Calvin.
Well, you know, anybody who used to tell me, oh, Calvin and Hobbes, it was so innocent. I didn't read the same strip. He was very subversive. I think that's part of the reason why that Bill Watterson style melds so well with that Frank Miller style. They both have this very subversive voice to them. And that's sort of the common denominator between these two otherwise very different properties. But the thing is that suddenly the roles have been reversed a little bit. Mm-hmm. And Locke is saying, well, we're under investigation, but we got to play things by the book. I want custody of my daughter back. Mm-hmm. And Spencer, meanwhile, you know, he's suddenly the one being like, you know, we need to just go out in the streets and like beat the hell out of somebody. Mm-hmm. Like, we're hunters. We need to get the scum off the streets. Mm-hmm. And sort of seeing that dynamic shift a little bit, mm-hmm. their dynamic is already evolving under pressure. Mm-hmm. And that's sort of the worst possible moment for a domestic terrorist like Roach to strike, mm-hmm. especially because Roach is a smart guy. He's very perceptive. Mm-hmm. And he figures out very, very quickly that he and Locke are kind of opposite sides of the same coin.
Yes.
And so is this town big enough for the three of them? Mm. You have to read and find out.
Well, the thing that's interesting to me is that Roach has some of the same things. He has imaginary friends or a friend or something. I don't want to spoil anything, but let's just say that they are opposite numbers. It's like that man and the Joker on some levels. He's like the perfect opposite number. And the funniest thing to me is, of course, this Roach Riley is based on Beetle Bailey, which is, you know, Beetle Bailey is like 180 degrees away from Roach Riley. I mean, he's, you know, Beale Bailey was a slacker. He would sit around all the time. And then Roach Riley is not a slacker. He's a go-getter type guy and stuff. So it's kind of interesting that you went a totally different direction with Roach Riley.
Well, it's funny because, you know, when I was originally pitching Spencer and Locke around the first volume, I remember one publisher who I won't name any names to protect the innocent, but they said, oh, this is the best pitch we'll ever publish. And they were like, oh, you know, well, what if you had like other comic strips? And I had already considered it. And I was like, oh, yeah, well, no, volume two would be Beetle Bailey immediately. I was thinking, when you think about the kind of threats that police officers face, you know, of course, street level crime made perfect sense for our first volume, because ultimately the first volume is about Spencer and Locke. It's not really about the people that they're facing. Mm-hmm. But when you start thinking about a sequel, then of course, you know, we've already established the heroes. Now it's the villain that we have to sort of make mm-hmm. sure is worthy of them. Mm-hmm. And so I thought, you know, one of the worst things that a police officer would have to face is terrorism. It's sort of this larger than life existential threat that, like, how can two street level cops really face this? Mm-hmm. And I thought, oh, well, the character of Beetle Bailey, you know, he's military. He's got the access to that hardware and that advanced weaponry mm-hmm. and that advanced training mm-hmm. and sort of that military background lends itself really well to these themes of trauma and PTSD and mental illness that we'd already brought up in the first arc. Mm-hmm. So it really just kind of felt like an immediate no-brainer to have this guy as our villain. Hmm. It took a little while to kind of get in Roach's headspace. Mm-hmm. I had thought of kind of a number of different angles for the character, and they all felt a little too complicated, a little too cute. Hmm. And it was only once I kind of stripped it down and just saw it as this kind of philosophy of, once you've had the worst day of your life, nothing else can touch you. Hmm. And it's a little bit like a logical proof, because, of course, yeah, like, everything's relative. And so, yeah, you know, if you kind of squint, it does make sense, especially to somebody who I would argue has endured just as much pain and suffering as Spencer and Locke, mm-hmm. but in a much more accelerated time frame. Mm-hmm. So it's a nice little war of ideas between the three of them. You know, Spencer and Locke, their whole arc is, can you ever get past your scars? And Roach, meanwhile, just revels in them. He's defined by them. And he's come back thinking, everybody should have a scar. And if I give it to you, I'm really doing you a favor. So, you know, Roach is a guy who, you know, he's a little bit of an artist. You know, he kind of loves his job. And I've referred to him elsewhere as almost an apostle of pain. And that's sort of this very nihilistic thinking that it could be actually kind of seductive for a pair that's as far gone as Spencer and Locke.
Wow. See, now I've read the first two issues of the second arc. How many issues are going to be in the trade? Four?
It'll be four. And that's in part to not keep any customers hanging on any longer than they need to, but also for my own personal sanity and my own pocketbook. Mm-hmm. You know, it takes a lot to write Spencer and Locke in particular. You know, it's very much, you know, you're walking a tightrope with it in terms of not only being authentic to these characters and being empathetic towards people with mental illness and trauma and PTSD, mm-hmm. but also it takes a lot just for production wise to put mm-hmm. it together. Jorge is an immensely talented artist, but, you know, it takes time for him to draw these beautiful pages. Mm-hmm. When we did volume two, he was actually working a day job in graphic design. Mm-hmm. And the thing that a lot of people don't realize is, I'm the writer. I have it easy. I can write five scripts in the amount of time that it would take for Jorge to draw one issue.
Right.
And it's actually physical labor for artists. And so, you know, if I blew out Jorge's wrist, that's a career-ending injury. So I always try to be as considerate as I can be, and just saying, you know, it takes time for not just the script to come together right, but the art, which is ultimately more important. And then, you know, there's a lot of other behind-the-scenes considerations. We had people asking us since the first arc ended, oh, you've got more coming, right? You have to have more coming. And, you know, I always like to say, it took us – we finished volume two, I believe it was November of last year, so November 2018. But then you have to take into consideration, well, what else is Action Lab publishing? What are the windows that Diamond can provide for us? Mm-hmm. So by the time that we were almost finished with the book, we basically were told you can either have it out in September of 2018, which we would not have it ready nearly in time for that, mm-hmm. or April of 2019. And so there's a lot of behind the scenes considerations. You know, it's just the nature of doing business. It's kind of, there are certain windows that are available to hit and others that just aren't. But I always try to make it a point that if we make our readers wait this long between arcs, I want to make sure that it's worth it.
Okay. Now, Spencer and Locke 2, the trade paperback's coming out August 7th. 3 and 4 are yet to come out, though, right? When do you know when they're going to come?
Yeah, issue 3 is coming out, I believe, on the 12th of June. Mm-hmm. I'm really excited about that one. That is our Killer Snowman issue. It's we also have an homage to one of my all-time favorite comic series. I'm not going to spoil anything, but if anybody wants to check out Joe Mulvey's cover for issue 3, you might get a little bit of an inkling of what's going on. Mm-hmm. And yeah, and then our fourth issue, I believe it's coming out the week of July 4th, our fourth and final issue. Wow. And yeah, it's going to be a doozy. I want to say it's my favorite action sequence I've ever written. And I've gotten to write some really cool action sequences just over the course of our first and second arcs. But yeah, issue 4, nobody's leaving anything on the table. It is really just a brutal way to kind of wrap up our second arc. It is, yeah, all I'll say is, you know, Spencer and Locke, they're going to have to dig in pretty deep if they want to come out of this in one piece.
Oh, wow. Well, so I got to see that. When you mentioned the snowman, all I could think of was Calvin and the snowman. The father mm-hmm. would come home from working a day job, and he would come in, yeah. and in front of the house. There's this beheaded snowman. There's somebody with a, you know, stakes all through, and all these different snowmen all over the place. Yep. And he always says, "I always know which is my house."
Yeah, we had a little cameo from the snowman in the first volume, and mm-hmm. part of the reason I wanted to do a sequel so badly was, you know, there's a lot of classic Bill Watterson iconography we couldn't fit in. Mm-hmm. Things like, you know, the killer bicycle mm-hmm. or the mutant snowman, the ones with like two heads, the zombies that were shambling around, or Stupendous Man.
Yeah.
This was sort of a way to catch up in some unfinished business. Mm-hmm. And yeah, I'm very excited for readers to see what we're up to. Jorge actually said this on Twitter earlier today, and I'm in full agreement with him. As much as I'm really proud of our first two issues, it's only getting better from here. Hmm. A buddy of mine from Newsarama, who is one of the harshest readers I've ever met, mm-hmm. told me when I showed them the PDF for issue 3, they said, "This is the best thing you've ever written." Hmm. And that's very kind of them to say. Yeah, we're swinging for the fences with this one, and I hope we connect. But either way, I'm just so proud of what the team's put together.
Well, you know, it's interesting because you're getting good reviews, as you were mentioning. Yeah. Somebody at Major Spoilers, this very website, called the book a sensational roller coaster ride of action and drama that will leave you waiting breathlessly for the next issue. That's Stacy Bauer, and he wrote that.
Yeah, Stacy's a sweetheart. He's great. Yeah, I mean, you know, and it's funny because Stacy is a fairly recent convert to the series. Mm-hmm. And that's something that has actually been so encouraging to me. And we talked about this a little bit at the beginning of the interview, but, you know, so much in comics, everybody is thinking about sort of the overnight success. What's the immediate return? Mm-hmm. And don't get me wrong, Spencer and Locke has, you know, had tremendous response. You know, the fact that we were nominated for 5 Ringo Awards, that we were, you know, optioned for film very quickly out of the gate. But at the same time, I have no illusions that, you know, I'm working with a smaller publisher. You know, mm-hmm. Action Lab has been very wonderful to us, but they don't, of course, have the sort of market penetration that a place like Image would have, for mm-hmm. example. Mm-hmm. And so what's been so encouraging to me is that even 2 years later, we have people like Stacy who are discovering the book for the first time mm-hmm. and still having that incredibly enthusiastic response to it. Mm-hmm. I was always worried that the book would come out and nobody would pay attention, and then it would sort of just drop off the face of the earth. Mm. And I've been so pleasantly surprised, and I think it speaks to really the quality of the team of, you know, Jorge Santiago Jr. And Jason Smith and Colin and our cover artists, Mon House and Joe Mulvey. People are just – they stand hard for our book. Mm. The legs that Spencer and Locke Volume 1 has had in 2 years has been astonishing. Mm. I can usually move 60 to 100 trades per show, per con of our first volume. It's been so wonderful. I'm on my third year of the convention circuit, and I have frequent flyers now. I have people who they'll come back year after year mm-hmm. to say, "I love the first volume. When's 2 coming out?" Mm-hmm. Or, you know, "I love volume 1. Do you have any more prints?" Mm-hmm. Or, "Hey, when are you guys going to start selling some Spencer plushies?" you know, mm-hmm. and especially as a first time, that was my first book. I mean, that response means so much to me, mm-hmm. and I know it means so much to Jorge and the rest of the team, because, yeah, you know, I've written for the internet, and you've written for the internet. You know exactly what it feels like, mm-hmm. where sometimes it feels like, is this thing on? Like, is anybody – and when strangers come up to you and tell you, you know, how much the book meant to them, or, you know, we've had people who have grown up in abusive households mm-hmm. come up and say that this book really meant a lot to them and really sort of made them feel a sense of catharsis. I mean – Oh, that like kind of blew me away when the first time that somebody told me that. And so much of it is luck, and so much of it is just, you know, timing, and so much of it is just working with the right team to get the right alchemy together for the right story. Mm-hmm. And for me, you know, it's always just about just trying to bring some empathy to our characters. Mm-hmm. Spencer and Locke is certainly a dark comedy, but it's never supposed to be a punchline at somebody else's expense, especially I think people who have really lived through these kinds of traumas. That's never meant to be the punchline. Mm-hmm. And I think sort of by Jorge and I always trying to be mindful of that, mm-hmm. I think that's at least part of the reason why our book has had the success that it's had.
Mm-hmm. Well, I've got to mention a couple of things, and I got a question for you. It's funny you say that because, you know, when I do this podcast, it took a long time. I must have been like 200 episodes before I finally interviewed somebody who said, "Oh, I can't believe I'm on this podcast. I listen to it every week, and man, I just can't believe I'm going to be a guest." And I went, "Really?" I had never heard anybody say that before. Now, since then, there's been other people I know, but it's just sort of funny that you say that because you honestly don't know, you know, until somebody says something to you, you know, what right. the response is to that.
Yeah.
The other thing is that now that you have gotten you've got the second volume, sounds like, in hand, you're pretty much ready to go.
It's done.
I can imagine you've already thought about a third volume.
Yep.
Have you thought of which comic strip you're going to go to? And you don't have to spoil, just tell me if you have.
Yes. Okay. The answer is yes. Okay. And, you know, it's one of those things that I plan for the worst but hope for the best. Mm-hmm. And it's still very early on in Spencer and Locke 2's lifespan. And, you know, we always want to make sure that there's enough demand to keep going because, of course, we don't want to – both in terms of being realistic and in terms of not beating a dead horse, you know, we want to make sure that fans actually want more of this before we invest a lot of time and energy and money into it. Mm-hmm. So far, our sales have been really promising.
Good.
And the cool thing about a book like Spencer and Locke is a significant number of our sales are reorders. Mm. Because what tends to happen is shops never seem to order enough, and then they sell out in like a day or two. Mm-hmm. And then they have – I know at least volume one, we had something – it was like 40% of our sales were reorders. It was an insane number. Hmm. So it's still really early on for volume two. And, you know, so that's why I always tell people, pre-order the book. If your comic shop doesn't have it, tell them to order it for you. But I'm feeling confident.
Good.
I'm feeling confident we will get a volume three. I know Action Lab has been very happy with how the book has performed, especially in trade. And they've also had the either fortune or misfortune, depending on who you're talking to, of tabling with me at a show and listening to me ask 500 people in one weekend if they like Calvin and Hobbes. You know, we have plans. You know, I would very much like to do a volume three, and as we get the official green light for that, I will be shouting that from the rooftops. There's a much wider universe to explore, and whether that is with Spencer and Locke specifically, mm-hmm. or with, you know, any sort of spinoffs, if I can make that work, mm-hmm. or I was kind of toying with the idea of a crossover with my next Action Lab book that comes out in September, Going to the Chapel. Mm-hmm. And I thought of an idea that I was like, oh, that's so stupid, but that would totally work if I could pull it off. Mm-hmm. Yeah, suffice to say, Beetle Bailey, there's not a whole lot of expectations with a character like that, so mm-hmm. I consider him kind of the summit of the mountain. Mm-hmm. There are some big names that I would love to tackle.
Mm-hmm. I can think of a couple. Peanuts, Nancy, mm-hmm. Other ones like that. There's a whole host of these that are out there that are just waiting for use.
Nancy's got a quick cameo in the first issue of Volume 2. Mm-hmm. I had actually written it well before the Olivia James reboot of Nancy. Mm-hmm. But we have a BDSM Nancy and Sluggo in our first issue. Mm-hmm. But yeah, I will say there are three big strips that we don't tackle in Volume 2. Mm-hmm. And it's because we've sort of put them in our back pockets for future stories. I will say, at minimum, I want to do one more arc. Three feels like we would say everything we have to say. Mm. But like I said, you know, I like to write modularly. And so if there's still demand after a third arc, mm. there are a couple of other stories that could be told. Mm-hmm. I'll go so far as to say I thought of a very stupid idea involving Mark Trail this weekend that I can't stop thinking about. You know, because I Mark is, of course, the lamest of comic strips, so mm-hmm. I feel like there's something really fun and badass to do with them. Mm-hmm. But there are, of course, some really iconic ones. I've told Jorge my ideas for a number of them. And he's like, that's awesome. And I was like, oh, okay, so we may be doing this for a little while longer. But at the same time, it's just making sure that, you know, we tell the stories that we have to tell mm-hmm. while the demand is still there. Mm-hmm. And thankfully, if our fans have stuck with us for this long and show no signs of stopping, that only leads to more encouraging things down the road.
Okay. Now, I've got to ask, you mentioned about being optioned. Do you know any more information about that?
It's very early on in the process, and I know it's one of those things that I live in Los Angeles, and it feels like time works a little differently out here sometimes in the fact that options, they tend to last a while, and it's sort of very hurry up and wait until things get done. What I can say is we've had some really cool conversations that I am hoping we will get to talk about sooner rather than later. Mm-hmm. I can say that we've got a really cool team that has been really pushing hard in the book. And I can tell you that out here in Los Angeles, people really have responded to the book. Hmm. People seem to really get what we're going for. And most encouragingly, you know, people seem to want to stay true to the spirit of the book. Mm-hmm. You know, there's a lot of people out there who would want to kind of sanitize it and sort of make it almost like a psych kind of procedural. Mm. And it's not to say that there isn't a world where that might exist, but I have always said in every meeting that I've gone to is my worst nightmare is for somebody to watch Spencer and Locke on any sort of screen and then pick up the book and be horrified. You know, ultimately, the book is just as much a calling card for me and Jorge's career as any sort of film or television show. And so all I can say is we've had a lot of people really excited about the book. And I'm hoping that we'll have something official to talk about very soon.
Oh, good, good. I'm glad to hear that. Because, yeah, you're right. The worst thing they could do is make it unrecognizable. I mean, if you're not going to do Spencer and Locke, do something else. Don't call it Spencer and Locke.
Right. I mean, and, you know, there are certainly success stories. I mean, you see what ABC is doing with Stumptown. Mm-hmm. That, I feel like, is sort of like the win-win scenario for everybody. Mm-hmm. I always try to temper people's expectations that mm-hmm. Spencer and Locke the comic is going to be different than Spencer and Locke the movie, similar to the way that the Marvel Cinematic Universe is different than the comics. The different mediums have their own strengths and their own weaknesses, and you want to try to lean into the strengths as much as possible. But, you know, at the same time, you don't want to go into any sort of multimedia with, you know, this thought of, oh, I'm smarter than the source material, because that's how you get rubber nipples on your Batmans. Mm-hmm. And thankfully, you know, I think Hollywood in a lot of ways has kind of smartened up from those old days. Mm-hmm. And it helps that the people that we've talked to, they're just as much fans of the book as we are. Mm. And that being able to talk with kind of fellow true believers is really nice. Mm-hmm. And ultimately, as long as we kind of stay true to the characters and their general arc, the other things I think are a little more negotiable and open to change, especially if it gets turned into something a little more serialized, mm-hmm. because you ultimately want to make sure, and this is something I always think about when I write, and it's something I think about when I look at the industry as a whole and when I review books and anything like that, is what's sustainable? What would sort of give this particular property the longest amount of legs, the longest amount of shelf life? Mm-hmm. And, you know, Spencer and Locke, our first volume, it kind of hit every possible check mark that I could possibly think of mm-hmm. in terms of sustaining itself. Mm-hmm. And I want to keep hitting those kinds of benchmarks as we keep going with the storyline as well. And mm-hmm. I know that everybody that's been sort of trying to push Spencer and Locke's multimedia future feels the same way.
All right. Well, I have to say that's encouraging to hear, because I've talked to some creators after they get optioned, they basically at some point throw up their hand and say, do whatever you want, because it's not going to be nothing. It's going to be related to anything that we've ever done.
I'll say that I spoke with Anthony Johnson right around when Atomic Blonde came out, because that was around when we had been optioned. Mm-hmm. And I told him, I said, hey, what advice do you have? And he's like, just sit back. You know, like, he's like, there's not I think a lot of times there's this thought of like, oh, you know, everybody's got this much control over this. And you learn very quickly in Hollywood that it's its own unique ecosystem. It's kind of like being in the middle of a flash flood and a tornado. And so certain things are just out of your hands, or they're out of your hands until a certain point in time. You have to think about, when do you get a script together? When do you get a showrunner together, or a producer, or a director, or a lead actor? What happens when you shoot it? What happens when you edit it? There's so many different steps that are going to happen before anything would ever hit a screen. That at this point in time, it's just building up the right momentum. And so I'm feeling pretty good about it so far. Fingers crossed. I mean, it's Hollywood. So, you know, some things languish for years. Other times, one thing changes and it immediately starts like powering into action. For example, look how long people were talking about the Matt Reeves Batman movie. They're talking about it for years. And now suddenly we have Robert Pattinson, which, you know, I guess he was afraid of tryout for Locke and Spencer and Locke. So I appreciate him getting this consolation prize as Batman. But now everybody's talking about that movie because you have a face to it now. And that's something that we're sort of just in the baby steps of for Spencer and Locke. But it doesn't stop me and Jorge from daydreaming about it.
Oh, yes. It's just, especially in this era of CGI, it couldn't be a better time.
Yeah,
this concept
exactly.
Right now. That's kind of interesting. I was thinking when you were saying about Star Wars, you know, here comes Star Wars out of nowhere and everybody's just going to the other thing. And Paramount goes around and goes, oh my gosh, we got to have a science fiction space thing. Do we have anything we can use? And somebody said, well, there was this little show called Star Trek. Oh yeah, let's make movies. So they rushed off and they made movies in a hurry. Boy, they flung that first movie together in a hurry.
Yeah, so, exactly.
So you never know.
It's a wonder that anything gets made, especially anything that's good or iconic or lasting. And so much of it is just based on luck and the circumstances around you. And once you realize that sort of there's only so much you can control, the more freeing it is all around.
Now, you mentioned a book that's coming. Talk about other projects that you're working on so we can keep an eye out for them.
Sure. Well, I have my next book, Going to the Chapel. It is also through Action Lab Danger Zone. It's going to be hitting stores in September. So readers will be able to pre-order it starting in July. It's Die Hard meets Wedding Crashers. It's about a gang of bank robbers that thinks it would be easier to rob rich people's weddings than it would be to rob banks. They're going to find out just how wrong they are. It's an action comedy. It's like if Quentin Tarantino tried to do a rom-com. And I feel like romantic comedies as a genre get a bad rap, both in the general popular culture and in specifically the direct market. I think there's a lot of preconceptions on what do rom-coms contain and who are allowed to consume them. And I think that's nonsense. A lot of my favorite movies are kind of twists on the rom-com genres. There's Eternal Sunshine of the Spotless Mind, which is, depending on when you're talking to me, is my favorite movie between that and Memento. There's 500 Days of Summer. There's About Time. They're all twists on romantic comedies, but you've got sci-fi. In this case, you can throw crime at it. I think rom-coms are just as flexible of a genre as science fiction or crime or fantasy or any other genre that most people would pick up in the direct market. And I wanted to write one that I thought guys and gals would have fun with. You know, there's a lot of similar to Spencer and Locke. There's a lot of action. There's a sense of humor to it. It's, of course, not quite as gritty. There's not quite the body count that we have in Spencer and Locke. But it's a love story. It's about commitment. And what does it take to say till death do us part? But it's also about dysfunctional families and being locked in a church with them for 12 hours, which I think we've all been there. So it's going to be coming out in September. I'm working with artist Gavin Guidry. This is his direct market debut. He has worked on backgrounds for Heartthrob over at Oni. And he recently did a Star Wars fan comic called Rebel. And yeah, no, he's terrific. He's kind of like in that intersection between Jamie McKelvey and like a Doc Shanner. And working with colorist Liz Kramer. This is also her direct market debut. I say she's going to be the next Laura Martin. She is astonishingly good. And veteran letterer Ariana Maher, who keeps me in line, keeps my one-liners flowing. And a murderer's row of cover artists, including Lisa Sterl from Long Lost. And Mon House, who's going to be joining us from Spencer and Locke. He's doing covers as well, in addition to Gavin. And then sometime soon, we don't have a specific publishing deadline yet, but we announced last year at Comic-Con, Top Cow, I have a book with them coming out called Grand Theft Astro. It's what if the Fast and the Furious had a baby with Back to the Future in space? I figured if you can drive it, people will race it, whether it's from horses to carriages to cars to spaceships. And I felt in the future, people would race spacecraft. They would call themselves star chasers. And this is the story, a star chaser who, in the middle of a race, accidentally tears open a wormhole 7 years into the future. And his immediate family has changed dramatically in his wake. His mother's passed away. His girlfriend has moved on. And his formerly younger brother has grown up to become a fearsome crime lord. And so that's how he and his brother are going to have to team up on a high-speed, high-stakes heist into space to pick up a piece of technology that might be able to bring him home. It's very much a question of what happens when your family leaves you behind. What happens when you are surpassed by the people that you always thought would be behind you? Do you want to go back and relive the past, or is the only direction you can move forward? So I'm working with Jordi Perez, the artist on Queen of Bad Dreams, on the book right now. I'm still writing it, and Jordi's still working on Queen of Bad Dreams, so it's still very early on in the process. But I've written about two-thirds of it, and I'm really excited with how it's turning out. It's a lot to pack in a space, sci-fi, time travel, heist thing into one book, but I'm really excited with how it's coming together. And yeah, I apparently really love car chases. I'm learning from everything I write, so this is a whole book filled with car chases. So hopefully I'll get this thing out of my system for whatever I write next.
Okay, well, it sounds really good. And I got to ask you, too, you mentioned about heroes. Are there other cons you're going to be going to this year?
I'm actually only in the first half of my conventions for the year.
I'm
going to be doing Heroes Con. I'll be doing at least part of San Diego Comic-Con, doing Fan Expo Boston, Rose City Comic-Con, New York Comic-Con, Baltimore Comic-Con, and then I'm hoping to do Los Angeles Comic-Con. That's currently on my schedule. I don't know if that's 100%, but if they have me again as a guest, I will be there for my hometown show as well.
Oh, cool, because I think the one I'm going to intersect with you, I think, will be Fan Expo Boston. We're going to go to Fan Expo Boston.
I'm excited. This is my first time. I went to college in Boston, and I haven't really been back since I left the Berkshires. So I'm excited to go back and see some of my college friends and hopefully see if we can tap into a new market there.
Cool. It'll be good. You're doing a lot of successful things. I think I can't wait to see what you got for Spencer Unlock number 3. I hope that comes because I think that would be really worth it. And I got to see 3 and 4 now. I got to know. I really wanted to told you I had heard of it, but I'd never actually read it. And that's why Sunday I finally got the chance to come over and buy the first volume. And I took it and I read it and I really enjoyed it. And that's why I reached out to you about doing this interview because I thought it'd be fun to talk with you about this because it's a great book.
I really appreciate it. And I mean, honestly, you are a terrific interviewer. And just hearing the questions that you've had about all this, I mean, boy, it gets me feeling all fired up. I feel like I could talk with you for hours about this. And I just appreciate you taking the time. And honestly, the success of a book like Spencer and Locke, especially at an indie publisher like Action Lab, it's one person at a time. And you helping spread the word about our book, we couldn't be more grateful about it. And we really appreciate your support. And we appreciate your support for Volume 2 and hopefully Chapel and Grand Theft Astro down the line.
Well, I'm looking forward to it. What I'll do is I'll link Stacy's review in my talk about the podcast. So keep it up. I wish you more success, but I don't know how much more successful you can get. But you got lots of good things going on, and just keep it up, Zlatan say.
Thank you so much. We really appreciate you taking the time.
People need dramatic examples to shake them out of apathy, and I can't do that as Bruce Wayne. As a man, from flesh and blood, I can be ignored, I can be destroyed, but as a symbol.
Get the latest from the comics universe. News, interviews, previews, and reviews. Listen to the weekly Wayne's Comics Podcast so you can keep reading your comics.
That's a wrap for this episode. Be sure to be back next week when I'll have another interview with a great comics creator. But until then, keep reading your comics.